This edition of the Art Review was first broadcast on the 9th of April 2015 on Monocle 24.
Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Tuck. Today, I'm joined down the line from Toronto by Monocle correspondent and book reviewer Chris Frey. We'll be discussing ex-Canadian ambassador to China, David Mulrooney's book on the relationship between the two countries, and we'll talk about the problematic term curator in a new release from art journalist David Balzer. Plus, we'll have some Brazilian fiction with Daniel Galera's latest novel, Blood-Drenched Beard. That's all to come here on the Arts Review on Monocle 24. Well, welcome to the show, Chris. We're going to begin with Middle Power, Middle Kingdom, what Canadians need to know about China in the 21st century. This is a new book by David Mulrooney, who was the Canadian ambassador to China between 2009 and 2013. It draws on his time in that role, the relationship between the two countries, and what Canada can learn from China. So, Chris, what can Canada learn from China?
Well, that's actually not very clear from the book itself. I think it's more about what Canada can learn from its relationship and how the relationship has occurred, especially in the last 10 years. I think this book being about China is a bit of a MacGuffin, because what's most interesting about this book is that it's a guide to understanding what Canada is getting wrong about diplomacy. So while there have been some progress in the past 10 years, when Stephen Harper first came to power, he initially took a rather antagonistic attitude towards China, which wasn't particularly helpful when building a relationship with what was rapidly becoming our second largest trading partner, and also it had been asserting itself on the global stage diplomatically. Canada sort of fell to the background in its relationship with China, although China was very interested in us. I think as Mulrooney says in the book, they were interested in engaging with us. We weren't interested in engaging with them. And so while on the surface you get these stories about his time as the ambassador, this very fascinating look inside the embassy and how things work, the real story here, I guess, is the diminishment of the Foreign Service over the past 30 years and foreign policy in general in Canada.
Yeah, that notion of, you know, Canada's foreign power, I know, is something that Monocle has kind of touched on before. And there is a kind of sense, you know, that, you know, Canada has so much going for it. One of which is not America, but it sits on this oil rich and kind of resource rich part of the world. It connects the two big oceans, the big trading oceans, but somehow its impact isn't quite what you'd imagine. And does he explain why this is? Does he feel it is just, you know, I know that in the book he says, you know, that the country has a kind of a national loss of focus, but what does he really kind of understand what is about Canada that really kind of misses the point?
Yeah, I think it's two things here to you know, break down. In terms of how Canada's attitude towards its foreign policy has shifted, I think the arrival of Stephen Harper marks a shift between, I guess, this what was associated with the Liberal Party, a more multilateral tradition, the role of peacekeeper. Really, Canada helped invent this idea of a middle power along with other countries like Australia. Canada being in the unique position where it was a natural ally of the United States and to some degree benefited from its protection, even militarily, and this, you know, going back to the Cold War, that in some measure gave Canada a bit of latitude to embark on other projects. And this came mostly through fruition under Lester Pearson and Pierre Elliott Trudeau. Pierre Elliott Trudeau being a bit of a bugbear of Stephen Harper. When Harper takes charge, you know, I think he announces that we need to take a more disciplined approach, a more moral approach to who we engage with and how we engage with people, that I think undercuts the whole idea of how diplomacy and foreign policy works. And Mulrooney gets quite specific, actually, in terms of identifying, you know, the reasons for Canada's declining performance. He talks about our confusion of the role of a middle power, and that's going back maybe over the past two decades. You know, how do you work within these limits while pursuing the country's interests? Rather, we've seen under Stephen Harper us resort to sort of megaphone diplomacy that erodes and undercuts any real influence it might have. He also talks about the poor management within government. There's a lack of coordination and information sharing across ministries. As ambassador, he often talks about, you know, having to speak to people back in Ottawa, and you'll have two different ministries with very conflicting ideas and interests when it comes to China and trying to consolidate them. He'll also talk about just the lack of a good ear back in Ottawa. I mean, you have seasoned diplomats in other countries who are trying to give their best, you know, read on a country and how to pursue Canada's interests, which often fall on deaf ears, and just a simple lack of leadership and coherent goals. And I guess the last and what has become most noticeable publicly is this sort of, your prioritizing of domestic political concerns or optics that trump diplomacy and any sort of long-term national interest. There's some great anecdotes about these obsessions with photo ops and how they've backfired. And you know, Canadian entourage will be in China and they'll be trying to arrange, you know, some of the people of the Chinese members of the entourage in a way that has angered the host. And there's all these little tiny anecdotes. They seem like a little bit offhanded, but they really do rub people the wrong way. And they crystallize this view of a sort of a national foreign policy, rather, that's more obsessed with optics and how things will play back home, especially as the Conservative Party courts, you know, the immigrant or the ethnic vote back home.
And just finally, tell me, before we move on to the next book, it's very good, you know, to have a clear message and to be critical of your what's happening in Ottawa. But is he a good writer?
Yeah, he is. It's a surprisingly entertaining book. And I'd say it's one of the most important political books we've had in Canada in recent years. I'd say the curtailment of whatever influence we've exercised, internationally, is a pressing concern. And of course, we have a big federal election that is anticipated this fall. I don't think it's going to slot itself in as one of the sexier books, you know, as the campaign unfolds, but I think it's one of the most important.
Well, that's Middle Power, Middle Kingdom, What Canadians Need to Know About China in the 21st Century. And it's by David Mulrooney, and it's out now, and it's published by Alan Lane. Let's move on now to our second non-fiction release. This is art writer David Bowser's book, Curationism, How Curating Took Over the Art World and Everything Else, and it's out now. So, Chris, this is a word, curator, I know that we've been critical of here on Monocle 24, despite us having a show named that as well. It has become the word du jour. In what sense does he believe that curating has taken over?
Well, I'd say that, you know, he does reach back into the history. The first half of the book is dedicated to a capsule view of art history and how he arrived at the present moment, and therefore going back to the Latin origins of the word curator, which has the shared root of both care and curiosity. He moves forward to the emergence of the Wunderkammers, or cabinets of curiosity, in the 17th century, and then the eventual emergence of the public museum, I guess, in the 18th and 19th centuries. And then a pivotal point comes with Marcel Duchamp, his famous ready-mades, and the presentation of objects as a creative act itself. And then he moves forward into the 90s and the true legitimization of curatorial practice, largely exercised through how museums and major galleries remade themselves in response to the times. You had this focus on attracting audiences through blockbuster shows, branding, and constructing these destination buildings designed by Starkitects. That's the first half of the book. It's more focused on the art world and how this overripe word curator has kind of emerged from that world of contemporary art and penetrated the rest of our lives. And I think what's important is though it's tempting to dismiss, you know, this idea of curator as all surface and pretension, Balzer here, he offers, it's an intellectual travelogue, I guess is the best way to describe it. And he does the necessary work of taking the idea apart, understanding what it means, and looking at how it's been extended across our lives, that in effect, you know, like you were alluding to, we're all curators in some sense, whether across a plethora of professional occupations or in our personal lifestyle choices. And in that second half of the book, he explores, you know, what this means for people who have jobs in the arts, but also for work and lifestyle in general, whether it's how social media and the internet are turning us all again into curators, but how the essential earlier meaning of the word is being lost, and how, if it's anything, curationism is primarily an act of expressing one's status and distinction.
I knew the game was lost when we had a shop review and the owner claimed to be curating their sock collection, which I realised things have gone rather badly. But is it, you know, how much of this does he think actually does come from the world of, you know, we all feel that we're kind of curating our lives on social media. Well, some people do, not me. and that we're kind of presenting carefully put together images of, you know, how we want people to see us. You know, is the role of the curator, one, does it spring from that, and two, is it a role of talent, or is it a role of, you know, having a nice eye? And I wonder often, even in the art world, you know, the role of the curator is so pumped up these days, you begin to forget that the person making the art is the star. It's the curator kind of wipes all out.
Well, and appropriately, and maybe not surprisingly, he begins his book, or early on, he discusses Hans Ulrich Obrist, familiar as the famous interviewer and curator, someone who, you know, may achieve a stature equal to or greater than the artist that he interviews and curates, and then he moves on from there. You know, how even as individuals and consumers or fans, we seek our own audiences by cultivating or organizing things. He does especially a good job in, I guess, in the last couple decades, which would be the terrain he's most familiar with as an art critic, in puncturing this idea of, you know, the individual as curator, as sort of this shallow affect of contemporary society. Although it's not just simply a screed, I would also say he smartly avoids the critical jargon or critical theory you'll often find in art books of this nature. And looks forward to a time, and I think he anticipates this coming soon, that this notion of curationism will simply exhaust itself. And he sees certain signs of that in the culture.
Yeah, it would be very nice to see a thing on its own these days, not surrounded by anything else curated. But he does use a lot of words which have kind of sprung into the contemporary lexicon, ideas such as experience designers, for example, and the experience economy. What's at the heart of this?
Well, I think we can all identify that. I mean, when we talk about ourselves today, whether we're journalists, you know, we work more firmly, I guess, within culture and society. But I think even how that's drawn out into all sort of areas of the economy, there's one interviewee he speaks to who talks about the curator as the most emblematic worker of the cognitive age, which sounds like a bit like rubbish, but. You know, it's one thing for it to be true or not, but certainly enough people out there seem to imagine or have adopted this idea about ourselves and the way we interact with other people, especially in a world so dominated by social media and the internet.
Well, that's Curationism, How Curating Took Over the Art World and Everything Else, and it's out now in North America and on the 20th of April in the UK. And if you want to hear the interview with Monocle's Rob Bound, which he did with David Bowser, then you can download episode 177 of Culture at monocle.com. It's all about the problems with that word, curator. Now let's end with the novel. This is Brazilian author Daniel Galera's Blood-Drenched Beard, which has been translated into English. Chris, tell us about this book. You recently reviewed it and you asked whether it could be a breakout moment, I think, for Brazilian literature. Is it?
Yeah, I don't know whether it is. I don't know whether any one book could be a breakout, novel for national literature. When I was in Brazil last year, and I was meeting with many publishers and editors at the various houses in Rio and São Paulo, there certainly was a firm sense of anticipation for this book to come out. I believe it actually came out in the UK last summer, and it just arrived in North America a few months ago. Tellingly, the reviews in the UK were a little more mixed, and they're much more enthusiastic. By and large, here in North America. Daniel's an excellent author. He was included in Granta's collection from a couple of years ago, Best Young Brazilian Novelists. Whether it was other writers I spoke with, editors or publishers, even from competing houses, they all seem to feel this collective investment in the book's success. It is a fantastic book. In the review I wrote, I was solidly behind it. It's one of a kind. I think Daniel is an immensely talented young writer, and probably is one of the best Brazilian writers working today. There's a lot of interesting things going on in Brazilian literature. They're very diverse. I don't think Daniel is necessarily a single great representative of it, and he should be, and this book should be sort of considered on its own merits.
And what is the heart of the story?
Well, the novel opens with the protagonist who, I mean, this is an important point. He suffers from a condition called prosopagnosia, or face blindness. It's an actual condition. Basically, you can't remember faces. So, I mean, you can imagine whether it's, you know, going about your daily life and not even be able to sometimes recognize your friends and family. And when the novel opens, he visits his ailing father, who announces that he's going to kill himself the next day. And during that final meeting, the father tells the story of his father, who apparently died in mysterious circumstances in a small seaside town in southern Brazil many, many years ago. And the circumstances are brilliant. There was a town dance one night. The lights go out. And when they come back on, the old man is, or not so old man, but he's a bit of a grouchy gaucho, I guess you could say, who's prone to getting in knife fights. When the lights come on, the man is dead on the floor in a pool of blood. He's riddled with stab wounds. And the problem with the investigation is everybody claims, you know, nobody saw what happened. And I guess the investigator, he eventually says, well, nobody killed him because everybody killed him. Like, the whole town killed him. He was not a well-liked man. So the protagonist, in the wake of his father's suicide, and he's reeling from some of his own personal troubles that aren't initially revealed, but he decides to go to this seaside town, which has since become a bit of a bustling, tourist place, beach town. Although he arrives in the off season, so you get this wonderful atmosphere of sort of the tourist town downshifting into the off season. And it would turn out that our protagonist happens to be a bit of the spitting image of his grandfather, particularly as he sort of lets his beard grow out and become more disheveled. And his grandfather has sort of been cast in the years since as a kind of mythical boogeyman for the town or for whatever evils befall it. And the book is a bit, I guess, part thriller and part psychological novel as the protagonist kind of disintegrates. Not surprisingly, the inquiries into his grandfather's death unnerve the locals. I guess I would call it a bit of a postmodern gothic. It certainly has the spirit of Borges in there, but unlike, I think, Borges has had maybe an unfortunate influence on too many South American authors who've been prone to mimicking Borges. But I'd say Galera does it in a wonderful way. He's by no way derivative of the master, but he really captures the spirit.
Well, it certainly sounds like one to pick up. That's Daniel Galera's Blood-Drenched Beard, and it's out now, published by Hamish Hamilton. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Chris Frey, thank you very much for joining us. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Tuck. My producer was Holly Fisher, and the show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for this week's film review with Tim Robey. But for the time being, thanks for listening.